A third grade teacher on the first day of class once asked her students to stand up and kindly give their name and favorite hobby. So the first student stands up and he says, my name is Sally May, and I like roller skating. And second student stands up. My name is James Burns, and I collect stamps. And third student stands up and says, my name is Morris Wexler, and I pledge $5. And it's a little joke anecdote that I heard years back, which I thought was appropriate, because it's not just 10-year-olds that unfortunately have a problem with knowing when and how tzedakah is appropriate. And for our final and last lecture of this conference, we'll be discussing different needs and priorities in tzedakah presented by Rabbi Daniel Feldman. Rabbi Daniel Feldman is a Magid Shir at the Stone Beit Midrash of Yeshiva University. He is a Musmach, received his Smicha at Yeshiva University, as well as its a graduate of its Kolel Elyon, and on top of a full-time Magid Shir, he is the director of Rabbinic Research at the Center for Jewish Future, and the author of The Right and the Good, Halacha and Personal Relationships, Human Relations, which is you could find outside, as well as three books titled Bina Bisfarim, and the co-editor of six volumes of Talmudic essays. And it is my great pleasure to call upon Rabbi Daniel Feldman to share his thoughts and insights.
Of Judaism and the Jewish people as a whole, and halacha is how we do things, and halacha is what we're all about. So one would think that tzedakah and halacha would be a terrific shidduch, and of course they are, but it's a complicated shidduch, because as much as we can talk about tzedakah from a halachic perspective, and as much as there is an important section of Shulchan Aruch Yoredeya where we have Hilchos Tzedakah laid out, where there are laws of Tzedakah delineated together in the same section of Shulchan Aruch with all other ritual laws. At the end of the day, it's very, very difficult to address Tzedakah as a straight halachic question. And when we talk about the question of priorities in Tzedakah and how exactly are we going to allocate limited funds, it is, at the end of the day, very hard to give a direct guidebook and say, ABC, here's what you do. And yet at the same time, in a sense, the Shulchan Aruch does do that. The Shulchan Aruch does have set rules, and the Chazal give us rules, and the Gemaras and the Midrashim. So on the one hand, there are rules, and on the other hand, in real life, these rules are very difficult to apply in a direct computer-type sense. So we struggle. We struggle because tzedakah is, at the end of the day, going to be discretionary. But on the other hand, that discretion is not random. It's a discretion that is informed by halachic values and halachic laws, and that is subject to being colored by how halacha is addressing the subject. And finding that balance to make a decision that is discretionary, but is discretionary not because this is what I think when I woke up in the morning, but discretionary based on the influence of halacha, is the challenge that we face. And the Vilna Gaon is quoted as having commented that the pasuk in reference to tzedakah in Parshas Re'eh tells us, "Lo sikpo tzesiyadcha," you shouldn't close your fist. And the Vilna Gaon commented that the idea is that when you close your fist, so your fingers look like they're all the same size. And then when you open your hand, you see it's not true. You see that all the fingers are different sizes. And the Gra apparently commented that this is true in general when we talk about tzedakah. We talk about tzedakah, so if we close the book, if we're just looking at the abstract, so then we could think that everything is a set standard and we could fit things into a formula and we could just plug things into a situation that we have in Shulchan Aruch. And you get into real life and you realize there's so many variables and you don't know how to measure and you don't know how to allocate and things don't fit neatly into a category and you don't know who to believe. which of course is a major element as well. So in real life, it becomes much more complicated. And the Gra said that's perhaps what we can get from this idea: lo sikpo tosyarcha, don't close your fists, that all the fingers look like they're the same size. Realize that this is an area of halacha where the computer type approach is not really going to do it. So this is our challenge when talking about halacha. And that's why, to a certain extent, in many communities, the decision has been made that perhaps the rabbanim, the rabbis who are well-versed in the laws of Stuck and in the values that we find in the Shulchan Aruch and in the Gemara, are perhaps uniquely qualified to make these decisions. And therefore, we have the concept of a rabbinic discretionary fund, the idea that it shouldn't be anybody's discretion necessarily, but it should be given to the discretion of those who are perhaps a little more well-versed in these ideas, and that it still goes to the discretion of individual, but the recognition that this discretion is one that is based on halachic values. So as we talk about various priorities, I'd like to talk about it in kind of a two-tiered way, that on the one hand, the decisions that we make on our own as far as how to give out our money, and on the other hand, this concept of a public fund, and maybe more specifically a rabbinic discretionary fund, and how that might be treated differently. And in perhaps most of the areas we're going to discuss, there are differences between private money, personal money that you're giving out, and a public fund or rabbinic discretionary fund. In specific, there are differences in how some of these ideas play out, and I'd like to talk about the two of them side by side. So just to begin with, one of the major issues that we confront when we're deciding to give out money, even if we have a pretty good idea where we want to give it to, so the question then becomes, so do we give things in one shot? Do we direct all of our money towards one place where we feel it's going to have a big impact? Or do we share the wealth? Do we spread things out a little bit, diversify, so to speak, so that we are able to affect many people or many causes, even if we don't get as much of a bang for the buck? So that was a debate, but very influential on this point is the Rambam. The Rambam has in his commentary to the Mishnah in Pirkei Avos, Pirkei Avos has a phrase a little bit hard to translate, and that's to the point where it says, Hakol lufi rov hamasa. Everything is measured or everything is based on the rov of the action. So what does rov mean in this context? Rov means different things in different contexts. So here the Rambam translates the word rov to mean multitude as opposed to magnitude. It doesn't mean something that is very big. It means something that happens many times. And writes the Rambam that really if you want to have a tremendous spiritual growth, so the way to accomplish that is through doing things many times. And if you have, for example, he writes there, if you have, let's say, $1,000, and you could either give somebody $1,000 in one shot, or you could divide up these $1,000 and give them to many different people. So the Rambam says the latter is preferable. Now, why is it that the latter is preferable? Why is it that he's telling us rather to give smaller gifts many times rather than one large gift? And it's an attitude that not everyone agreed with. The Maharal of Prague and Rabbi Yaakov Emden took a different attitude, and they thought concentrated gifts maybe are preferable. But if we take the Rambam's view, and again, the Rambam has been very influential in this discussion, so why is it that spreading it out is preferable? So really, there are two ways to look at it. One way is the way that's really more suggested by his language, and that is that it's more beneficial to the giver in that way. And the truth is, this interpretation really is what fits more into his language. This is what his words seem to suggest, that I, as the giver, will get more of a spiritual lift by giving tzedakah 1,000 times, $1 1,000 times, than by giving $1,000 one time. Because every act of generosity, every time I have to conquer my instinct to hold on to my money, every time I have to take out my wallet and train myself in kindness, so each time that has an effect on me, and therefore I'm better off doing 1,000 acts of kindness, even in small times, in small doses, than one big gift, which only makes me pay the price once. That's the more likely way to read it based on his language. One could also take this attitude and apply it differently and say that it's not necessarily because of that, but it's because this is more important to the world. The world is better off when charity is divided more evenly, when it's spread out in a wider style, and to have it all given to one place and have everybody else suffer from inattention is simply not good policy for the world. Now, that may not be the Rambam's intention. As we mentioned, the words don't work as well with that interpretation. But it does work better with the Bach. The Bach is one of the primary commentaries on the side of the Tur, of the early code of Jewish law that predates the Shulchan Aruch. And the Bach in the laws of Purim, when he discusses the obligation of Matanos Levyonim on Purim, we have a particular obligation to be involved in Sukkah. So there the Bach writes that it makes quite a bit of sense to him. It seems very indicated to him that somebody who could give either $100 to one poor person or $1 to 100, it seems indicated to him that the second path is far preferable. So in essence, it's the same position as the Rambam, but here he goes on to explain why is it better. Because the person who is given to 100 people has sustained 100 people instead of sustaining one person. So it's clear from the Bach that his emphasis is on how many people you're making better off. That it's better to do a little bit of improvement to a wider group of people than to give a big shot in the arm to one person. So this basic position, which the Rambam and the Bach share, at least at its core, that we promote diversification, again, has two possible angles to it. Either the one that's more likely in the Rambam, that it's better for the giver, it does more to promote generosity within you, or the Bach's view, that it's better for society as a whole. So these are two different perspectives on what's basically the same opinion, and the truth is it makes a difference. It makes a difference for our two-tier discussion. That on the one hand, if we're talking about a private fund, so then it's a valid concern that as I give tzedakah, so it's worthwhile for me to also figure how will I benefit spiritually from the way in which I make my decisions. And if I'm going to say that I'm going to have an increased spiritual improvement because I'm giving it out to many different people, so that's a fair decision to make. But if we're talking about a public fund, if we're talking about a fund that you're managing of public money, so then the decision becomes different. So then it's not really legitimate to make your decisions based on what's going to be good for you, the manager of the fund. It's not your money. You have to really evaluate based on how you're doing your job in the best way, and therefore you have to look, so am I going to have a better impact on the world by giving out to many people? Then that becomes a stronger element. So again, the Rambam and the Bach basically saying the same point of view, that diversification is the way to go, but the question of why they say it, is it for the giver or is it for the recipients, is one of the many issues that's going to play out differently whether we're talking about a personal fund or we're talking about a public fund. And this idea that the world is better off by having it spread out a little bit, this idea that the Bach is telling us, this we also find in the Talmud in the Maseches Erevin, where the Talmud talks about the priestly gifts, the sustenance that the Jewish people provide to the Kohanim. And there the Talmud tells us that somebody who gives all of his gifts to one Kohen is bringing about famine to the world, is bringing about an imbalance in the world, that this is simply not a healthy way for society to live, for one person to get all of your generosity, and it's not necessarily such great advice. And the Shulchan Aruch records this. The Shulchan Aruch does write that it's not a good idea for one to direct all of his charity into one direction. Now, what exactly does that mean? So the Maharsham, commenting on this, the Maharsham in his Tshuvas, one of the great poskim, writes that this is only true if you're going to do this your whole life. That if all your tzedakah that you ever have, you always give to one person, so then that's not really great policy. But let's say you do things on a month-by-month basis, and you had set aside money for January, you set aside money for February, you set aside money for March, and in March somebody comes to you with an especially powerful story, and you feel that this is something you really want to be involved in, so to give all of your money for March to this one cause, that's legitimate. The Shulchan Aruch is telling us that over the course of a lifetime, to focus only on one recipient, that's something that causes a severe imbalance in the way tzedakah is given to the world, and that's not a great idea. And here again, you find another difference between public funds and private funds. Yaakov Kamenetsky, in the comments that were printed on Shulchan Aruch a number of years ago, Yaakov Kamenetsky suggests that this idea, again, is especially relevant to one who manages a public fund. Because if you manage a public fund, so you also have to worry about making sure that people donate to the fund. And if you give all of the money from the public fund to one space, to one place, so then people who are contributing are going to feel there's something off here. They're going to feel that this is not a great use of their money, and they're going to reduce their donations, whether that's fair or not. And that's also something you have to worry about if you're managing a public fund. So this is yet another area in which there may be a difference between a private fund of money and a public fund, whether it's a rabbinic discretionary fund or any other type of public fund that's being managed of such money. So, when we talk about the needs of a poor person and we talk about evaluating how much to give, so then that also raises questions. And we know here that the Torah has a phrase which the Talmud takes in a very broad sense. The Torah talks about giving de machsoro, about giving a person that which he is lacking. Thank you very much. Giving a person that which he is lacking. And the Talmud really seems to interpret this in a very broad sense. The Talmud says that even if somebody was very wealthy and he used to have slaves running in front of him as he walked during the day, so then you have to supply that as well. So that's quite of a broad standard. My teacher, Rabbi Aaron Levine, was recently discussing this topic, and he noted that this is not a lifetime deal. That this is in order to ease somebody through the pain. If somebody has a sudden reversal of fortune, he was very wealthy, and then all of a sudden he loses it all, and it's a very jarring experience, and he needs to be eased through it. That perhaps that's what the Talmud is talking about. That it doesn't mean that for the rest of his life you're going to arrange that he's going to have this type of grandiose display, but for a limited period of time, it's important in order to reduce the jarring effect that this person is going through. So that's what the Torah is telling us in that case. But in any event, the broad idea seems to be that there is a standard that a person is used to, and it's our obligation to try to replace what was missing from their lives. So if that's true, that's quite a obligation. And that's quite a burden for you to take on, even for one person. And some commentaries ask, how does this match with another idea that we have? The Talmud tells us in Maseches Ksuvos also that there were limits placed on how much stucco we should give. That even though we recommend the limit of a minimum of 10%, but the Talmud says there's also a maximum, and that maximum is 20%. That the average person shouldn't give more than 20% of his stucco, 20% of his money to stucco, more than a fifth, because if that's true, if he's going to give more than a fifth of his money, so then he himself is going to end up on the public till, he himself is going to have to take stucco, and that's not going to help anybody. So therefore, the Talmud says we recommend you give at least 10%, but not more than 20%. There are exceptions, and Chafetz Chaim and others talk about various exceptions that exist. For example, if you have somebody who's an usher muflag, somebody who's ridiculously wealthy, so then he can afford to give away 95% of his money and he'll still be 10 times as rich as everybody else. So then that's not what we're talking about. But the average person in a middle class sense, if he's going to give away more than 20%, that's really going to affect how he's able to live. And therefore, we have this limit. So if that's the case, so how does this match with something like De Machzor? So if you're going to take upon De Machzor of even one person, that's going to cost you a tremendous amount. So how exactly do we relate to, on the one hand, the Torah giving us this very high standard for how much we're supposed to help out people, and on the other hand, this limit, which certainly is going to fall way short? And the answer seems to be already in the Ramah, in the Code of Jewish Law, the Ramah's comments, where he notes there that De Machzoro is not really an obligation on the individual. De Machzoro is an obligation on society, on the community as a whole. The community has an obligation to look out for the people in the community who are having a hard time and to together work towards the standard of bringing them up to that which they are missing. And it's not something that any individual has to take on by themselves, but the community as a whole is supposed to address themselves to this issue. So if that's true, it makes things a little more realistic, even though communal money, of course, also is certainly finite and probably won't reach this goal either. So the point really is that this is kind of the upper limit. This is telling us what we're shooting for if we had infinite money, what we're trying to strive for. And then the community as a whole gets together and tries to reach this level. Now, the Shach on the side of the page of the Shulchan Aruch points out that this is not the only opinion. There were those who understood De Machzoro as being an individual responsibility rather than a communal responsibility. But it seems that the Ramah took this view that this is the case, that it's a communal responsibility. And in contemporary authors, Rav Vosner, the author of the Shalos and Shuvos Shevet HaLevi, he points out that in any case, reality has ruled like the Ramah, that the only way to view it is that it's a communal responsibility. It doesn't seem feasible at all to see it as a individual responsibility. That's not something that we are able to accomplish. So the community as a whole gets together and looks out for the people who are in the community who are going through a hard financial time, and they should take upon themselves as much as possible to try to fill in whatever is missing. And the Ramah also mentions there, something which has also become a major function of Rabbanim who are trying to help out people who are in need. And that is that if you're not able to help, or if you're not able to help in a significant manner, so then at least what you should do is, says the Rama, to be modio tzaro l'rabim, that you should tell the public about what this person is going through. Then we know that this is something that rabbis do, that very often when they speak to somebody and they're not able to help them, but they can write a letter, and they give them a letter to take around to other people. And the letter says, people should know that this person is in need of help, and if you're able to help him, then that's a good thing to do. And that is also included within the Rama's description of De Machzero. This is also apparently included within what's going on here as the responsibility of Staka. There is a difference, of course, between people who are in the community and people who are not part of the community. And this is also something the Shulchan Aruch talks about, that when somebody is himself diversifying, somebody's himself not just coming to you, but he's going to come to you and come to everybody else. After today, he's going to go to the next place. And then the next time, it's the next place. So then there isn't, on the surface, an obligation of Deim Achzero. And then the Shulchan Aruch talks about giving a small gift, giving something of a very limited nature. There's a discussion on the side of the page what exactly that means. Various debates about various details. It seems to me something comparable to the value of one meal. So you take care of him in a very limited way. But when somebody is roving around, he's not part of this community, but he's going to go from community to community, so then it seems clear that the obligation of De Machzero doesn't devolve upon that community for this person who in any event is going to go to the next community the next day anyway. And this really brings up another issue that's kind of lurking in the background. When we talk about how do we decide who do we give to and who do we not give to, so there is a very big concern here, and the concern is that we may be in violation of biblical prohibitions. This is something that on the side of the page of the Talmud, the Tosfos points out, that in Parshas Re'eh, in addition to the commandment for us to open our hands and to give tzedakah when we're able, so the Torah also says two languages of prohibition. The Torah says there we shouldn't close our fists and we shouldn't harden our hearts, which seem to be saying that we shouldn't say no. Somebody asks us for tzedakah, not only do we have a positive obligation to help out, but if someone says no, then they're apparently in violation of some type of transgression. So that's a very scary thought. So we're approached all the time by people, and we're making decisions all the time to say yes to this one and no to that one. So how do you deal with this question of a possible biblical violation? So to make it even worse, it seems that there are some Rishonim who would even say that these prohibitions would apply even if there isn't a request. If you know there's somebody around who needs help, but he hasn't been tovei, he hasn't come and asked, there may be a prohibition. That seems to be in the minority. Most poskim seem to assume, like the view of the Rashba, one of the great Rishonim, that this is true only if the person comes and asks. That doesn't really help us. We have enough people who come and ask. So out of the people who come and ask, so that still is a very scary thought. Are we to say that there's a prohibition if you say no, if you decide that somebody else is a worthier cause? So are you in violation of the prohibition? So there are a number of approaches to this, which kind of mitigate it somewhat. On the one hand, there is the approach of the Imre Bina, was the Kalash Rav, the great Rav in Yerushalayim, that this goes together with De Machzero. So when you have an obligation of De Machzero, then there also is a correlate prohibition of saying no. But again, if you have somebody who's roving from town to town, so his obligation is not really upon you personally, so then the parallel prohibitions don't apply. And in some of the Svarim on Hilchos Staka, for example, there's a classic sefer called Staka Mishpat by Rav Bloy, who wrote a lot of important halachic Svarim. So he discusses how do we relate to the very frequent letters we get in the mail asking for tzedakah, and we can't say yes to all of those either. So his inclination is to see this as something which is not under the heading of De Machzero. These are coming from out of town. These are people who are not part of your community. And if you can help them, that's great. But if not, that's not something for which these prohibitions would apply. In addition, and this may be the saving grace, there is a strong attitude in Svarim that we should look at the words of the pasuk, where the pasuk say, don't close your fist and don't harden your heart. And that may very well be a key ingredient. And that some understand, perhaps this is a key understanding here, that the prohibition applies when you harden your heart, when you say you don't care about stuck, when you say you don't care about helping the person out. So then that's when we have a prohibition. That's when it's very damaging to who you are and to the whole midah of Rachmanis and to the whole approach of Jewish charity, if one says no because he doesn't care. But if you say no because you have other causes that you have to support, or because you've already hit 20%, or you've already hit your limit, or because you're not sure if this person is 100% trustworthy, or for whatever reason you have, which is in the larger interest of tzedakah as a whole, to say that you're not going to give your tzedakah here, you're going to give it somewhere else. So many posts can feel that that would not put you in violation of these prohibitions, and that they got a big saving grace. Otherwise, all of us would be in big trouble with every request that comes. Okay, so that's as far as that's concerned. So then we get into prioritizing between people. So how do we do that? So the first priority that you find in this forum is actually family. Family comes first. And if you have family members who need tzedakah, so then that takes the highest priority. That's the first thing to worry about. So here again, you have something which would seem to play out very differently, whether we're talking about private funds or we're talking about public funds. So family would seem to be a concern that by definition could only apply to private funds. If I'm deciding how to give out my tzedakah, so I should give it to my relatives first. But if I'm in charge of a public fund of other people's money, then for me to favor my relatives would probably be an abuse of the fund. That would probably be very wrong. And that's how the Sfarim reflect that for me. Then there's a Rishonim, a comment on the Gemara like this. Rashi has a comment like this in the Gemara, that when the manager of a public fund decides to say that he's going to give to his relatives before everybody else, so that's really basically an abuse of his power. So does this halacha of preferring the family make a difference at all for public funds? So it might. There were some poskim who mentioned that maybe I should prioritize people who don't have rich uncles over people who do have rich uncles, because the people who have rich uncles, really the rich uncles are supposed to be supporting them. And maybe I should take greater concern over those people who don't have that. But that's a very hard call for people to make from afar, and who knows what type of access people have to the relatives and the maisa. If somebody's not being supported by the rich relatives, so in the end of the day, they're just as needy as everyone else. So it's hard to actually factor that in. So on the surface, this seems to be another area where it's going to make a difference whether we're talking about public money or whether we're talking about private money. In private money, there is this idea to prefer the relatives. And in public money, that's not really a viable system. Now, there is a system the Shulchan Aruch talks about of merit, of prioritizing people of higher moral character, moral fiber, prioritizing those who are very righteous over those who are less righteous. And that's also a very difficult factor to put into play in modern times. And Rav Kook has a tshuva about this, in which he writes that this is not really a distinction that we're able to make, and we have to show compassion to all. Now, again, when you're giving out limited funds, so strictly speaking, such a distinction is on the books. But again, practically speaking, we're not really capable nowadays of evaluating people's moral character or deciding this person is worthy and this person isn't worthy. And that's the way Rav Kook writes, and other posts can write, that nowadays it's not likely that this merit-based factor is going to have much of play in the way we make our decisions. Although here again, there may be a difference between public money and private money. And this was a comment made by the Tshuva Spetzel HaChachma, Bezalel Stern. Is a great posik, the author of the Tshuva Spetzel HaChachma. So he comments that this distinction between those who are more worthy and those who are less worthy, that only makes sense for a public fund, because a private individual is supposed to prefer his relatives. So if we say that this distinction between greater tzaddikim, for example, and less great tzaddikim is going to apply to everybody, so then everybody on the planet is going to give to the great tzaddikim, and then everybody else is going to get nothing. So when we're talking about private money, so then we factor in more relationships and things like that. And we're talking about public money, so then the public money can prioritize based on who they deem to be most worthy. So what if the issue of worthiness is one that's directly relevant? For example, let's say you have somebody who refuses to work, somebody who's capable of working but refuses to support himself. So there is a comment that the Ritva, one of the great Rishonim, has, and where he seems to suggest that such a person would not be worthy of being supported. But again, that's a difficult factor for us to determine. Some contemporary posts can say they would draw the line at pikuach nefesh. If it became life-threatening for such a person, they would still make sure that such a person gets assistance. And other posts can point out even further than that, that it's very difficult for us to really ascertain why somebody's not working. That even if it looks to us like somebody is able-bodied and is able to work and is just choosing not to, so very often there are things that we don't really understand. We're not really able to see the whole picture. And therefore, it might be reasonable to say that a person who knows that he could be working and is choosing not to, so there might be a prohibition on that person to take from tzedakah which other people are more needing of. But for the person giving out the tzedakah to make a decision based on that, to say, okay, well, this person could be working and this person needs it more, that's a hard decision for anybody to make, and probably, again, is something that's not going to play a large role in how we make these decisions. Okay, so this gets us to perhaps the most famous of all rules of prioritization in Tzedakah, the one that we're all familiar with, the idea that Chazal have, that Aniye Ircha Kodmim, that those who are the poor of your city, whatever that means, and that's a topic of much discussion itself, so that takes the highest priority, that before you worry about people from far away, so you have to worry about the people who are closest to you. And the Meiri, one of the great Rishonim, writes that this is really the ultimate in rules. This rule takes over everything else. Everything else is working within this rule that we prioritize based on who is really within your town. Again, whatever that means, something we'll talk about a little bit. There is a comment about this in the Sefer Panim Yafos. The Sefer Panim Yafos was a Sefer on Chumash, Sefer written on the Torah. And it's really more a homiletic work. It's not a work that you often find quoted in halachic sources. But in this case, it's different because the Panim Yafos was one of the Rebbeim of the great Chassam Sofer. Moshe Sofer is one of the great poskim of all times. And the Chassam Sofer, in his response, is very influenced by his Rebbe's comments here in this work, Panim Yafos. So therefore, this statement that you find in the Panim Yafos on Chumash has a great impact on Halacha, mostly through his great students, through the Chassam Sofer. And the comment that the Panim Yafos makes is on the verse the Torah has in Parshas Re'eh, in talking about the need for tzedakah. So the Torah says, Ki yihyeh b'cha evyon, when there will be within you an evyon. What is an evyon? An evyon is a word we use to mean somebody who's needy, but the truth is it's a stronger word than, let's say, ani. An ani is a poor person. An evyon is a more evocative term. It means something a little bit more powerful than that. It means somebody who's truly indigent, truly penniless. And the rabbis interpret on this phrase that it's related to the word to'ev, a person to need something. And therefore, comment Chazal, kol ha-to'ev, to'ev kodem. Whoever is needier, that takes priority. So it says the Panim Yafos that that's really the key criterion, that really all of our rules of prioritizing are really working off the assumption that we're talking about people who need comparable things. That you have a person starving here and you have a person starving 1,000 miles away, so pay attention first to the person starving here. But if you have a person starving far away and the guy next to you needs a new car, so then the priority is going to be to the person who's further away, because the first issue that we look at is how needy they are. So all of this, and this is what the Chassam Sofer writes in his Tshuvos also, based on this comment of the Panim Yafos, all of these issues of priority are assuming that people are coming from comparable need. If they're coming from very great differences in need, so then these issues wouldn't apply. Unless we're talking about family. And that's the Panim Yafos also writes that before you have the word Evyon, you have the word Becha from within you. So the Panim Yafos, and again the Chassam Sofer say that when we're talking about family, that's a whole different issue. Family is always going to take priority. And the Chassam Sofer writes, when we're talking about a situation, in his case, he was talking about somebody who had to give tzedakah to his father. His father's going to take priority, even if his father's needs are less pressing than somebody far away, because family is its own standard. But after we go beyond family, so need becomes the dominant view. So again, this becomes very unscientific. So we hear Aniyei Ircha Kodmim, we have family being a big priority, we have people nearby being a big priority, and we have need being a priority. And again, how to evaluate this in a neat mathematical scientific way is a challenge. And the key point that emerges is to be aware that these are priorities, that we're prioritizing based on need and based on proximity. And we're finding somehow a balance between the two. And a number of other issues are raised within this whole discussion of Aniyei Ircha Kodmim. And one of the issues that comes up, and this was discussed by a great contemporary posek, Rav Nosson Gestetner, the author of the Tshuvos L'Horus Nosson. So he discusses in his Tshuvos, so why is it that we have this rule? Why do we say Aniyei Ircha Kodmim? Why don't we just say everybody's equal? Why do we decide that Aniyei Ircha Kodmim? So he suggests one reason there, which I think he rejects. I don't think he thinks this is really the real reason. One point he mentions there, which would have limited relevance in a modern context, is ein mavirin al ha-mitzvos. We have a policy that we don't pass up an opportunity to do a mitzvah, and we say, I prefer an opportunity down the road, I'm going to skip this opportunity now. You're supposed to, other things being equal, take the first opportunity that you have. So the idea that you're going to say, well, I could give tzedakah over here, but I'm going to look for a further away opportunity to give tzedakah. So maybe that's the issue. Maybe that's the reason we say Aniyei Ircha Kodmim, because we have a general hesitation to skip over near opportunities to look for farther opportunities. But that doesn't really seem to explain everything, because as he points out, there is a debate. For example, there's a debate the Torah quotes debate among Rishonim. What if you have somebody who lives somewhere else, but now he's come to your town in order to raise money? So now he's in front of you. So would you call that Aniya Yircha? So the Torah assumes not. The Torah assumes Aniya Yircha means people who actually are part of your city. So somebody who comes away from somewhere else and is there now is not really considered to be part of your city, even though there were those who disagreed. The Torah quotes the Rebar Barach, who thought that this person would have a status of your town. That's not the way we assume. So if the issue was we just don't want to pass up opportunities, so we could say even if somebody is visiting, but they're here now, the opportunity is right in front of me. So it doesn't seem like that's really the issue. It doesn't seem like that's the reason we say Aniya Yircha Kodmim. What seems more indicated is that the reason we say something like Aniya Yircha Kodmim is because this reflects the general attitude we have towards chesed and towards our view of responsibility towards the world. There is a very interesting idea that Rav Shimon Shkalp is one of the great Lithuanian Rashi Yeshiva. He wrote in the introduction to one of his classic works the following point. Rav Shimon Shkalp writes that there is a Mishnah in Pirkei Avos, which is often quoted, and it's usually understood in a slightly different way. Hillel tells us in Pirkei Avos that im ein ani li mi li, if I'm not going to be for myself, so who will be for me? Who will be for me? The kishani la'atzmi, but if I am only for myself, then ma'ani, then what am I? That's the way we normally translate the statement of Hillel. And within that translation, so it sounds like it's a tension. It sounds like it's a balance. We're always struggling between our needs for ourselves and our needs for the world. So on the one hand, we know that we have to come first. If I'm not going to worry about myself, nobody else will worry about me. But kishani la'atzmi, if I'm only worried about myself, so then that's not so great either. So as Rav Shimon Shkalp explained there, that really we shouldn't necessarily read this as two points of tension, two opposite points that are bouncing off each other, but rather this is really one continuum. That yes, it's true, the human beings have to stay alive, they have to support themselves, so they have to prioritize their own needs. It may not merely merely. If I'm not going to be for myself, so who will be for me? However, I do have the ability to define the word ani, me. I can define that in various ways. I could define that as ani, myself, the individual. I could define that as ani, me and my family. I could define it as me and my community, me and my city, me and the whole Jewish people, me and the whole world. And therefore, a measure of a person's greatness is how expansively does he define this term. Does he define it in a very minimalist sense and say it just means me? Or does he see as broad of an umbrella as possible, including as many people in a straight line as he possibly can? So that's the way he reads the Mishnah. Ein ani li mi li. If I'm not for myself, who will be? But kishani la'atzmi. If I choose to define the word ani as me, myself, so then what am I in the end of the day? Then I'm nothing so impressive. But if I choose to define ani in a broader way, if I choose to include not only me right here, but me, my family, me, my neighborhood, me, the world, the broader circle I take, that's going to define the greatness that's involved here. So therefore, the idea of ani yircha kodmim is going to represent the idea that a person is not just looking at himself in a narrow sense, but he's seeking to broaden that umbrella as much as possible. So logic has it that he's going to include the people closest first and then spread that out a little bit further, and always including the whole time the people closest within that circle. So that's the logical way, perhaps, of understanding Aniya Yircha Kodmim, that chesed is supposed to go in a straight line. We're supposed to go first to those closest to us, and then if there's more left over, we go beyond and beyond and beyond, etc., etc. So within that, we find a few other possible ramifications and issues within Aniya Yircha Kodmim. The Shulchan Aruch goes on to tell us that the next priority after Aniya Yircha is Aniya Eretz Yisrael. That Aniya Eretz Yisrael, the poor of the land of Israel, should also be high on our priority list. And there's somewhat of a discussion as to why that is. So why do the poor of Eretz Yisrael take priority over the poor of any other country if they're not next door to you? So one angle that we find there is that this is a aspect of Yishuv Eretz Yisrael, that settling the land of Israel, the mitzvah of settling the land of Israel, it refers to living in Israel, but it also refers in the broader sense to doing what's possible to help sustain the land of Israel. So therefore, whether or not one is actually living in Israel, if one is supporting those who are, if one is making life in Israel enhanced, So that also is an aspect of Yishuv Eretz Yisrael, and that's one angle that we find in some Svarim. And you also find the idea that this is a different version of Aniyei Yercha, that Aniyei Yercha represents that we are worried about people in our tchum, people in our geographical area. So the whole Jewish world considers Israel to be at the center of its concerns, and therefore we're Aniyei Yercha in that sense. And also reflect back that all of the world outside of Israel is affected by what happens in Israel, spiritually and practically, and therefore in both sense, going in both directions. So Aniyei Eretz Yisrael is very possibly an extension of the idea of Aniyei Yercha. Is there a preference to Yerushalayim within Aniyei Eretz Yisrael? So some thought there was a discussion about this in the Tshuvas Sam Sofer. And in later generations, in our times, Rav Osner and his Tshuvas, he thought that the proofs that Sam Sofer brought to this point were a little shaky. And if we were going to view Yerushalayim in that sense, it would be a reference to the old city of Yerushalayim, to the Beit HaMikdash. It's not necessarily a practical concern nowadays. So Rav Osner, for one, doesn't necessarily distinguish within Eretz Yisrael. He views all of Eretz Yisrael as one category. So there is an interesting discussion about this point, a dispute that took place between Lahavdil ben Achaim ben Achaim, between Reb Chaim Sanza, the Sanza Rebbe, and Reb Chaim Volozhiner, the head of the Volozhiner Yeshiva, as to if you have a group that makes aliyah from an identifiable place in Chutz Laaretz, let's say you have a group that all goes together and founds a community in Israel, and they maintain an identity as the people from this city outside of Israel. So does that city outside of Israel have a special obligation towards this community in Eretz Yisrael more than the rest of Eretz Yisrael? So that also goes to the question, how exactly do you view things? Do you see this as, well, all of Eretz Yisrael is a priority in and of itself? Or this is a reflection of the fact that Aniyei Yercha are the people who you have a connection to, and therefore, even when they've gotten up and moved, and they're in Eretz Yisrael now, they still have a connection to you perhaps more than others in Eretz Yisrael, and maybe they should take priority as well. So that was a debate. And another debate that you find in Poskim is, what about the conflict between Aniyei Yercha and Aniyei Eretz Yisrael? If you have to decide whether to give the money closest to you in Toronto or to give it to people in Israel, so what takes priority? So here the majority of Poskim probably understood, this is the way the Bach understood, and the Shach, and a lot of the Poskim on the side of the page of the Shulchan Aruch, that really Aniyei Yercha is again the key factor, and Aniyei Eretz Yisrael comes after that. But there were those who disagreed, there were those, the Chidah has a tshuva about this, that Aniyei Eretz Yisrael takes priority even over Aniyei Yercha. And I was discussing this topic once with the Menahel of Yeshiva University, by Zvulun Chalap, and he noted that perhaps in a modern global village kind of context, one could perhaps see the extra logic on that side, that even though a majority of Poskim probably rule that Aniyei Yercha take priority over Aniyei Eretz Yisrael, but in a modern context where people are in communication with people around the world all the time, and where we're all linked electronically and through very fast communications. So on the one hand, there is a little bit less of a sense of identification with those who are geographically closest to you, because there isn't as much of an advantage communications-wise and transportation-wise as there was once upon a time. And there is a stronger connection with those in Eretz Yisrael than maybe there would have been 150, 200 years ago, because again, the level to which we can be in touch and the level to which you can go back and forth. So he thought that maybe that minority view that actually felt that any Eretz Yisrael would take priority over the aniyim of your town maybe has a little bit of support from changing circumstances. But again, the majority of you in Poskim, and even among contemporary Poskim, such as again Rav Osner and the Shevet Alevi, was that this is really the priority of Aniyei Yercha, really takes first priority, and even all the other factors that are involved in why you would support the poor of the land of Israel, that's all important, but Aniyei Yercha is an overwhelming priority, and that's going to come first. But another important point within that, and this is something that the Chassam Sofer emphasizes, and he also considers this to be an obvious point, even though there were those who debated it. The Chassam Sofer wrote that this is all of this prioritization is only telling you how to proportionalize things. That it doesn't mean that if we're going to decide, okay, here's your priority list, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, so it means you give all your tzedakah to number 1. And then if number one is totally taken care of and you still have a few bucks left, then you give it to number two. And if you can totally take care of number two, then you'll move on to number three. So if that was the case, so then it would lead to a very skewed division of charitable funds. And the Pashtus is the way that Chassam Sofer writes, and any other postman agreed with him, that it doesn't mean that, that Ani Yerecha Kodmim, or any other priority that we find within Halacha, means that you give the bulk of your tzedakah to this person, and then what's left, you give a lot of it to the next person on the list, and then what's left, you give a lot of it, etc., etc., so you give far higher percentages to those who are closer, to those who are higher on the list. But to say, I'm going to give 100% here until it's filled, so that's going to very much skew the division of tzedakah, and that's really not what we're looking for. So that further complicates things. So again, so all of these different criteria, so now the Chassam Sofer is telling us, but still, even if you were able to have a list, you're able to have your computer print out an exact list, who's number one and who's number two, you still have an additional cheshbon to make, how exactly you divide about how much number one gets, how much number two gets, how much number three gets, et cetera, et cetera. And this just goes back to our point that at the end of the day, again, it's going to be discretion. Again, it's going to be judgment. Although you do find Svarim talking about exact percentages here, maybe a third here or the like. But at the end of the day, again, we're talking about a certain amount of discretion, a certain amount of decision-making that's going to be up to you. And the bottom line is that as much as we're informed by the halachic values, as much as we expose ourselves to what the posts have written about this, so then our hope is that decisions we make will be decisions that reflect the underlying values that the halacha is trying to tell us. So the truth is a lot more to say about this, but we're almost out of time, so I'm just going to quickly try to recap what we did say. We spoke about the fact that this is a challenging topic in general because regulation in the area of tzedakah is a little bit beyond possibility because discretion is always going to be an element. But at the same time, to be exposed to the halachic values is a core activity so that we know that our discretion is a halachic discretion. And to that extent, the Gaon commented that when the pasuk says don't close your fist, it's because when your fist is closed, it looks like all your fingers are the same size and it looks like it's all one thing. And when you open your hand, you see that the fingers are all different sizes. So too, when it comes to tzedakah, we have to understand that the book gives us one impression and real life gives another impression, and therefore discretion is always going to play a role. And we talked therefore about also the rabbinic discretion that is a little bit more informed by halachic sources, and that perhaps explains why there is a rabbinic discretionary fund. And we talked about therefore how this could be taken on two tiers, a personal decision and a public decision, and how a lot of the issues in halacha are going to be affected by that. We talked about the position of the Rambam that diversity is the way to go, spread out your money. And we talked about two ways to understand that, either because it helps you spiritually or because it helps more people. And the second one is more clear in the words of the Bach, and which view you take may affect if it's talking about private money, so then you're going to go for what's going to have a bigger effect on you. But if it's talking about public money, you don't have a right necessarily to do that, and you have to worry more about how it helps the world. And that's what the Gemara says, if you give all your madness kahuna to one person, all your priestly gifts to one person, and you're going to starve the world, it's going to skew things. And the Shulchan Aruch says you shouldn't give all your tzedakah to one person. We mentioned the Maharsham says it's only true if you're doing it your whole life, but once in a while it's not so terrible. We mentioned Rebecca Kamenetsky's comment that again, if it's public money, you have to worry that people are going to think the system's not fair, and you have to also take that into account with how you give out money. So then we talked about the priority of Demachzor, or the fact that Torah says you have to give a person whatever he's missing, and the Gemara expands that in a very broad sense, even if he's used to great luxury, and it could be that's only true temporarily, until he's able to settle into a new lifestyle. But the question is, again, how are we supposed to manage that if you're only supposed to give 20% of your money to tzedakah, so how do you take on Demachzor at all? So it's very likely, the way the Rama writes, that really this is a communal obligation, not individual obligation, even if that's a debated point, but the reality seems to indicate that's the only possibility. And therefore, the community takes upon the need of those people in the community who are in the situation. And if they can't do it directly, they can write a letter. And that's also something the Rama writes and something the Rabbanim do. They write a letter to tell people what this person needs. And if a person is not from the community and he's roving around, so then the post can write, it's a lower standard. You don't have to worry about everything he needs. But you give him a little bit of a gift, what may be the equivalent of, let's say, one meal. So then we talked about the question about the prohibitions of los sikbos, los ames. You can't close your hand, close your fist, you can't harden your heart. So how do we deal with the fact it might be a prohibition? Even since some Rishonim say that it may be a prohibition even if you don't get asked, so then how do you deal with it? When you get asked by enough people, isn't that a problem? So we mentioned the Imre Bina's view that if there's no day machzor, there's no prohibition, and that helps a little bit. As the post can point out, it helps the letters we get in the mail if you can't say yes to all the letters. And also a crucial point that if it's not coming from hardening the heart, it's coming in because you've decided within Staka that you've tapped your limits, you don't trust this person, or you've got worthier causes, that may all be legitimate. That's not necessarily called hardening the heart. Then we talked about priorities within who you give to. We talked about the fact that family comes first. That's the biggest priority, but that's, again, a public decision, a private decision, not a public decision, because a public fund manager cannot prefer his relatives. That's an abuse of power, although maybe he can make a decision based on who has rich relatives, who to prioritize, but that's very hard to do, practically speaking. And we talked about the question of merit. Shulchan Aruch does talk about a sliding scale of merit, but again, as Rav Kook points out, that's also not something we can really apply, and that we basically try to show compassion to all. And then we talked about the issue of somebody could work and chooses not to work. Does that make a difference? And that is unlikely to make a difference as well, because it's also something we can't evaluate. It might mean that you shouldn't take if you know you could work, but the person who's giving out the sukkah probably doesn't have an obligation to figure that out per se. And then we talked about the concern of Aniyah Yerech HaKodmim, with the most famous concern, which Miri writes, that's really the whole deal. And we talked about the Panami office's comment that this is all assuming equal needs, Tzorchem Shavim, that the Pasuk says, Ki Yebecha Evyon, Evyon means needy, the person who is the neediest comes first, unless it's family, Ki Yebecha, family comes for, even before that. And that's the way his great student Nachum Sofer records in his Tshuvas, that family comes first, doesn't matter whether they have equal needs or not, but beyond that, it's basically equal needs. And we talked about why an Yerech HaKodmim exists. Is an idea of we don't want to pass up mitzvah opportunities, but if that's true, even if somebody came from outside but was here now, we would prioritize them, and that's not the way we rule the halacha. So therefore, it's probably a reflection of the fact that chesed goes in a circle outward, that as Rav Shemeshkop explained, that we try to define the ani in the broadest sense as possible and include as many people within our spectrum as we possibly can, and that therefore this affects how we make our decisions. And we also brought in the factor of an Eretz Yisrael Kodmim, that the poor of the land of Israel get the next priority, and we discussed whether that's because it's like fulfillment of the mitzvah of settling the land of Israel, or it's because those who live in the land of Israel are considered to be like from your town for whatever reason of the reflexive value in both directions. And we talked about how that would be affected if you had a community from outside of Eretz Yisrael that maintains its identity within Eretz Yisrael. Do they take priority for that community elsewhere or not? That was a debate among Reb Chaim Volozhin and Reb Chaim Sanzer. And then we talked about the question of whether those who are in Eretz Yisrael, do they even take priority over the poor here? That most poskim thought not that way, that the Aniyei Ircha of your town take priority over everybody. And there were some who thought in Eretz Yisrael take priority. And we mentioned that in the global village where communications have made it that you could be closer with somebody several thousand miles away than with somebody next door, there is a little bit more to say for that position. But again, the majority of you still seems to be that we give first priority to those who are nearest to us, that is the ultimate value. And then we just mentioned also the point, as the Chassam Sofer points out, further complicating things, that even if we were to decide this one comes first, this one comes second, this one comes third, it doesn't mean that all of the stuff goes to that person and then whatever is left over goes to the next person. I'm just telling you how you proportionalize, that you give the majority to the closest person and the majority of what's left to the next person, et cetera, et cetera, but never just giving it all to one person. And again, this further complicates the cheshbon, which just ends us with our point that it's all going to boil down to our discretion. But our hope in this discussion is that we have given ourselves a little bit of an opportunity for this discretion to be informed by the discussions of the poskim throughout the generations. Thank you so much. Have a wonderful afternoon.